My name is Martin Newman, and I'm the consumer champion. After 37 years in consumer-facing industries, believe me, I have seen it all. My goal is to play a role in providing consumers with a voice, to connect with brands that they've engaged with, and to help companies to learn from their customers where they're going right or where they're going wrong. You're joining me on Customer Centricity, the podcast. Each episode, you will find me in conversation with leading business people, discussing some of the key issues around how to empower positive change for consumers and brands. Before I introduce our guest for this episode, let me tell you a little bit more about customer service action. Just like you, I've been on the wrong end of some staggeringly bad customer service. We've all experienced it, haven't we? Whether it's the rude waiter or having to wait 40 minutes in a queue. And just like you again, I've also been delighted by an amazing experience when I wasn't expecting it. But aside from telling the manager or writing a rather awkward thank you note on TripAdvisor, what can you really do when something is great or when it's not so good? My frustration has always been not knowing how to raise these issues with the brand in question in the first place, or whether in fact I'd be even wasting my time by doing so. For these reasons, I launched Customer Service Action, a platform where people can share their good and their bad customer service stories and experiences in one impartial place. My vision is that we can collectively make a difference and create the change that consumers seek, and in turn help businesses too. Good customer service and good customer experience leads to successful brands. So please visit us at www.customerserviceaction.com to learn more. Thank you for listening to Customer Centricity. And now for our guest. Riz, welcome to my podcast on Customer Centricity. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me, Martin. Pleasure to be here.
We have known each other for quite some time. I was trying to remember, you've got a better memory than me. How long are we talking now? It's got to be at least 12 or 13 years, is it? Is it more than that?
I think it's about 14 years. 14 years. Yeah. 14 years. It's been a long time. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
That is a long time. Well, listen, it's been great. It's been really great watching your career flourish and see you go from, you know, where you were when I first came across you and when we first got to meet, to where you are today. Why don't you talk a bit about your background and just tell us about kind of your CV and where you've been, because you've got an incredibly interesting background. Tell us about that, Riz, would you?
Yeah, I've been around the world, to be honest. Born and raised in the UK. Grew up with my dad. I always tell the story with my father. He always used to take me to his dry cleaning shop in the summer holidays, in the evenings, on the weekends. I used to hate it at the time, right? And maybe do his cash flow statements with a calculator, with a ruler on a piece of paper. So not the way we do it on spreadsheets today. So I decided I didn't want to do a business degree. So I went and did computer network engineering in 1999. And never knew e-commerce, never knew digital was around the corner at that time. And after graduation, I worked for Carlton Warehouse as in the web team. As a webmaster on a brochureware website, and really from there we launched e-commerce right across Europe. Phenomenal growth, right? We went from doing nothing online to tens of millions online. So it was a brilliant grounding. And then worked for a number of other retailers in the UK, like American Golf. Went out of the UK, out of the retail industry a little bit at CPP, Card Protection Plan. That's where we met. Insurance industry. And then, I've been in retail ever since. In Australia, I worked for a specialty fashion retailer out there for plus size women called Taking Shape. And then over to the Middle East for the past 7 years. I've been based out of Dubai for seven of them. And then for the last 6 months, I've been based out of Cairo. And as part of being based out of Dubai, in my last organization, about 60% of our retail was across Southeast Asia. So lots of travel, lots of work, lots of experience across Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, Hong Kong, Macau. Was there pretty much every month. So, and now I'm, in Cairo in the jewelry industry. So kind of done every single industry you can possibly imagine, right? Alpha Team, for example, my last organization, we owned the franchises for IKEA, Marks and Spencer, Ted Baker, Guess, Ace Hardware, you name it, every industry. So kind of jewelry is probably the only one I haven't done. And that's where I am right
what's
now.
What's the name of the business that you work for today then?
Lazerde Group. So it's jewelry business, wholesale, manufacturing and retail and digital.
Yeah. Yeah. And just going, I mean, what fascinating background. And I think I might have had some input into you ending up working on the other side of the world.
So absolutely. I've had some input in
your career. Well, a couple of different stages, but...
Sure.
What I'd be interested to know, and I think I'm sure the listeners would be interested to know, is having worked in all those different markets and all those different environments, and guessing that they're all at different stages, you know, of evolution with regards to kind of retail, e-commerce and digital. What can you share any insight around that just in terms of what you found?
Yeah, I think UK and Australia are quite similar. That's what I found in terms of the consumer as well, right? In terms of the way the businesses operate and also the consumer. But what I found a trend is the markets like UAE, Saudi, and the GCC region and the Middle East region, really, even though they were late adopters, their speed to catch up and almost be at a point of innovation is quite phenomenal because they've caught up very, very fast. So that so although all the markets that I've worked in, entrants have been startup very fast. I'm talking a year and a half, 2 years. They're matching the best in class around the world. And in many cases, exceeding that. And I think, you know, especially in the Middle East, the UAE government and the Saudi government, these guys are really pushing the digitization agenda. And they themselves and their offices. I mean, Dubai now says they do not have a single piece of paper that touches a desk in any of the governmental offices. Everything you want to do, whether it is buying, you know, renewing your lease, paying your house bills, paying your telecoms bills, everything is done through a central portal. So the governments have helped speed it up as well. But I suppose in what I found in Southeast Asia and in the Middle East is this payment method known as cash on delivery, which just was alien to me in the UK and Australia. Where you can actually do your online orders and you pay at the door on delivery. It started off as cash on delivery. There's now delivery drivers are taking payment terminals with them so you can pay on your card. I think that's quite innovating, actually, because it eliminates that fear in markets where e-commerce starts that a customer always has. We had in the UK of don't know what will happen to my credit card, not confident paying online. It eradicates that. But it brings a whole heap of other challenges with it because customers buy willy-nilly and actually not really serious about receiving it, so reject the item. So that causes a completely different kind of dilemma and dimension to the logistics part of it. But innovation, so you know,
So basically the couriers turn up with the goods that somebody's placed an order for online and they actually reject it and say, I don't want it anymore.
Reject it or don't answer the call or are not contactable. Wow. So that in the early days was quite tough. In UAE, it was about 80% of all orders were cash on delivery. Now it's as low as 5 to 10%. Similar in Saudi, it's decreasing. I mean, our own business in Saudi, cash on delivery is 15% of the total orders. Actually, a year ago, it used to be 65%. And the game changer for us was buy now, pay later. Like Afterpay, Clearpay, for example, you know those very well. This transformed us. So now 51% of our orders are coming from buy now, pay later. And there's a lot of innovation also happening in this part of the world that you just wouldn't think of back in the UK.
Can you tell me how big is e-commerce then in as a sector, you know, within Egypt? I mean, in the UK, at the moment, it's you know, 27-28% of all retail is online. What's the percentage in Egypt, just out of curiosity?
In Egypt, it's quite small. It's just starting right now in Egypt. It's less than 2% right now here, but much bigger population. Saudi is higher. I think it's close to 10% now. And the UAE is similar levels to the UK now, 20 to 25%. So, you know, it is fast driving growth. And I think Egypt is right for it. 100 million population, young demographic that buy internationally, actually, but not enough retailers in this region have gone online yet. So you can see that absolutely exploding when they do.
Yeah, got you. Listen, I know that you're like me, very consumer centric, customer centric, and customer centricity is a big focus for you. Can you give me an idea of what you think some of the main barriers are? I guess you've touched on some of them already in terms of the innovation that you've started to implement, but what are some of the main barriers in terms of businesses being able to transform to become customer centric in your experience?
To be honest, Martin, there's just one thing that you can do to fix it, and that's the management. You need to have management, you need to have the CEO, you need to have your C-suite that actually believe in it. If you think many times when you, before you started your business, when you were working for Ted Baker and all the retailers you were working for, they start a meeting every Monday morning. What was our sales target versus budget? What was the margin versus budget? What was the cash margin versus budget? And these are very important KPIs, of course, to keep a business running. But never and very rarely do you hear in a boardroom, what was our customer satisfaction score? What was our NPS score in the last week? And I think introducing those KPIs is very important. And without introducing them, you will have problems. And you've seen big household names who maybe even 10 years ago we never thought would go bankrupt in the UK, but have gone bankrupt and no longer on the high street. And I think the reason for that is not because you know, they did anything wrong in terms of their business buying sourcing strategy. It's just they never listened to the customer. They never put a focus around it. If you walk into a lot of retailers, the old ones like Debenhams, for example. I remember many, many years ago, I walked in once, I wanted to return something. And then the guy just starts reading on a piece of paper the terms and conditions of the business. They're relaying that to me as a customer rather than dealing with me in that individual situation. And I think having those right KPIs at a management level will then allow that to transpire down to the training, the framework we build for people in store and head office. You know, so I think totally the biggest barrier is that.
Yeah, totally. I totally agree. You know, I think at the end of the day, if you don't have that customer centric mindset at board level, and what you were really describing there is what I call focusing on the what we do at the moment, and what you were describing in terms of the traditional reporting that we tend to focus on is where we focus on the outputs and not the inputs, because it's the customer's. It's the net promoter scores and customer satisfaction and those other more relevant, you know, measures, if you like, that give us a real understanding of actually what's going on and why it's going on. Whereas reporting on margin and sales and profitability, and whilst we need to report on that, it doesn't actually tell us what's going on in the business. So I would agree 100%. Tell me something, when you start in a new role, and I think this is really interesting given all the different environments that you've worked in, because all the countries that you've worked in have their own unique cultures, if you like. How do you make sure when you start in a new role that you take all the other stakeholders in the business with you on a journey? Because your roles have all been about transformation, with digital transformation at the heart of them. So how do you make sure you take other people with you on that journey?
Yeah, very good question. I think it's important for people to know what's in it for them. So I think for each area of the business, if you get what's in it for them, that's the golden nugget, because there is very clearly people have this notion, right, that digital is going to change their jobs, they're going to lose their jobs, the traditional people. And that's their belief. And belief drives behavior, right? It's a phrase I've always used. My dad always used to say to me, you behave based on your beliefs. And if you just take a step back and in life, think about that phrase, it's true. Your behaviors, you know, look at COVID situation. We're all locked in our house. Sure, that was sort of government policies. But even after the government policies were listed, there's many people afraid to go out because of the belief that they had in their mind. It was a true belief at that time, don't get me wrong, but I'm using it as an example. So I think being able to, having the right boss is very important, and making sure you choose the job that you go into with the right boss is very important, because if he doesn't or she doesn't believe in it, then you've got no chance of changing the rest of the sort of C-level suite. But I think for the retail director, you know, how digital could grow their sales, showing them, doing use cases, doing, you know, hack jobs to prove the point and show the value, and then doing the full scale sort of launch afterwards. And you've got to be a bit careful with that statement, because if you start to do too many hack jobs just to prove a point, you're starting to not really be strategic. It falls into the realms of reactiveness to prove a point. Sure. So you've got to I think show the retail director how his or her store sales can increase by 20% through digital rather than decrease.
Yeah.
And it's important to differentiate the word of e-commerce and digital, because I think that's a big misconception as well. People automatically assume digital means e-commerce. E-commerce is a segment of it, right? And if you do drive your agenda internally as a business that digital is just e-commerce, then you are going to take sales away from the store. You're going to create internal competition where you have different pricing online, and inevitably at the end of the day, that's going to drive the downfall of the business. So it's important to highlight what's in it for each department.
Sure. I think that's a really good point. I really like that. I think one of the ways of doing that is to make sure everyone's pointing the same direction, where you start to have some shared KPIs. And my thing about customer centricity is, if that's the North Star for the business, that we want to turn customers into fans, that's what we're trying to do, and we do that by becoming a truly customer-centric organization, then we implement synergistic KPIs across every part of the business, which then helps to make sure everyone's kind of pointing in the same direction. Then you can, because if you measure people in a similar way around similar metrics, or, you know, at least metrics that contribute towards customer centricity, then they can be rewarded for that. Whereas at the moment, we reward all the different business units differently, because it all relates, it's all operational metrics about that specific business unit, which can often be, I think, a conflict with actually turning the business into truly customer centric. So it's a great point. You know, I think what's in it for me, and also just one thing to add to that, I suppose, is that change, you're an agent of change in all the businesses that you've worked in. You know, change often is perceived to come at a cost, isn't it? So it's the opposite of what you were saying. People almost always feel that change is going to be uncomfortable, and it's going to mean I'm going to have to work harder or learn new things. And most people don't like change. That's the reality. You do, I do, but most people don't.
Yes.
Most people feel uncomfortable with it. So I think by helping them recognize that actually there is something in it for them, because the business will become more successful, and that adds up to greater opportunity, probably in terms of remuneration, career progression, and all the rest of it, right?
Absolutely.
It's a really good point.
Yeah.
Tell me, what's your perspective on the high street? Maybe bring your head back to the UK for a second, if you don't mind. And what do you think, you know, do you think the high street's got a future? I've got a very clear view of it, but I'm interested to know your perspective.
Absolutely. 100% without a shadow of a doubt, it's got a future. I think the notion that digital or e-commerce, and this is my previous point, confusing e-commerce and digital, right? Because it's not the fact that the high street is going to die, it's going to change, right? And I think if retailers can adopt the last point we mentioned and embrace change, high street can thrive better than it's ever done before, right? But it's got to be down to the individual businesses wanting to drive that customer centricity approach. And there's a few businesses out there that do that very well, but many are still on a journey, and some just aren't even looking at change. They're in the still traditional mode at the moment. Open up a shop, stack it with stock, and sell as much as you can. So I think absolutely it's got a future. I think digital, and that's not e-commerce, is going to help transform the experiences that you can provide and the personalization you can provide to each individual that walks through your door is going to be the key. And I think if you can provide that personalized experience that a lot of e-com engines are talking about, you know, got hyper-personalization capabilities, take that to the store. And that's a lot of what we're doing here at Lazerde. We're going to be taking that into the store. So each customer is treated as an individual. And I think their needs are met. And if you can adopt that tool set, that mindset in your stores, it will thrive for sure. Because customers will love, even the millennials and the Gen Zs, Gen Xs, you know, the future generations, they have a, as people, as human beings, we like to go out and about. We want to go to the stores, but we want to have the right experience.
Sure. Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think that I agree, and I think the high street will evolve in a number of different ways in terms of the overall environment that's available to us as consumers, you know, in terms of food and beverage, entertainment, leisure,
yeah,
you know, the ethics of the environment as well. I think a lot of that's going to change. Plus, there's quite a big move in the UK towards, you know, residential property being developed in and around our high street. So whereas, you know, 30, yeah, 40 years ago, we all moved out to the suburbs, you know, with the increase in single people, et cetera, and the property development, if you like, within our city centres and our high streets, that's going to bring a lot more customers back into those environments who are going to actually be living there. But I totally agree on a kind of experiential retail level. Just this week, actually, I went into a store in Westfield called Situ Live, S-I-T-U Live. It's a really interesting concept. I did a post about it on LinkedIn, but essentially, you can't actually buy anything there and then, and they're not selling products in the store. But what they are is a showcase for brands. And of course, there aren't many brands manufacturers like, you know, Apple are one of the few brands that have been able to successfully, you know, set up their own stores and do really well. Most brands kind of struggle to make them profitable and to deliver the type of experience that consumers are looking for. So you go into this store and they've got exercise equipment, they've got, you know, they've got a home environment, they've got a live chef who's cooking stuff all day long, you know, so they're creating, yep, the type of environment that almost imagines what your house could be like and all the different elements of it, but they're actually bringing it all to life. It's really clever.
Yeah.
And they make their money not by selling products, but by charging the brands to be in there in the first place. But it is true experiential retail, you know, in terms of what it feels like to go in there as a customer. Plus, you don't have the pressure of being sold to, because that's not what the role of the staff is. The role of the staff in the store is to actually bring the products to life and give you all the information that you need. If you then like what you see, you can scan a QR code and you can potentially go online and buy it or find out where the best place to buy it is. So it's quite a clever concept.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant.
Yeah, it's really clever. Really, you should definitely take a look.
I'm going to visit that next month when I'm back.
Right, please do, please do. Please come and say hello to me as well, right? We need to grab a coffee when you're back.
For sure.
Tell me, the metaverse is all the buzz at the moment, right? Give me just a couple of minutes, if you don't mind, of your perspective on what you think the metaverse is all about and what retailers should be thinking about or planning in terms of the metaverse.
Hot topic, you know, metaverse. I think it's got a future. I think the concept and sort of the underlying technology is still developing. However, a number of brands are experimenting. For example, Nike have partnered with a couple of games, Roblox, Fortnite. My boys are hooked on those games, so I know about that collaboration quite well. You know, Nike are proactively recruiting people for the field, you know, virtual material designers, you know, to design products for the metaverse. You know, Gartner predicts, I think 25%, they mentioned, of customers will use metaverse by 26. I wouldn't focus too much on that percentage, but I think directionally, you know, more and more people are going to start to use the metaverse as customers. I think directionally that is where we're heading, because if you look at a couple of brands in the fashion industry like Gucci, Dolce & Gabbana, they did NFT collections, right? And a number of brands are taking part in the Meta Fashion Show, you know, that's coming up. And Gucci, for example, just on that Gucci point, they did 6 million in NFT collection sales. And there's a, I think there's a French business called RTFKT, the tech business that set up, you know, in the metaverse field. They did a partnership with a teenage artist called Fewocious, Fewocious, to sell, you know, sneakers or trainers paired with virtual ones. And they sold like 600 pairs in 6 minutes, a value of $3 million in 6 minutes, right?
Incredible.
Samsung last month, they did a live selling metaverse event to launch the latest Samsung phone. That was brilliant. I'm not sure if you've seen it. If you haven't, Google it, you'll find a video for it. It was brilliant. Yeah. And, you know, token.com, these guys have announced that more than 60 brands, including the ones I've mentioned, DKNY, Tommy Hilfiger, Estee Lauder, are all taking part, you know, in that. And so my sort of summary is, I think retailers should be thinking about how they can use the metaverse to engage with their customers and communities in relevant ways for them. So I think, as with anything, you know, first movers have an opportunity to get into potentially be the new frontier of that. And the store example you just mentioned, you can imagine stores, Samsung's metaverse, live event happening in the store, right? On big screens, you gather customers, there's an experience, and then they buy, you know, so you can, there's a lot of opportunity for it. But as I said, it's the tech is still developing for it, but a lot's happening.
Yeah. Well, I think what's interesting is you gave some great examples there of brands that have actually monetized it already, which is exciting, right? I mean, my view, I mean, I'm kind of aligned with Gartner to some extent in the context of you have an adoption cycle generally with anything. And I think where I see the metaverse at the moment is we're still in that kind of innovation stage, which is where tech-focused people such as yourself are getting involved. And then you've got the early adopters, which is probably where I sit, you know, which is, you know, people that have a vision, but maybe aren't quite there right at the beginning. Then you've got the early majority. And I guess what the Gartner quote or the Gartner percentage suggests is that the early majority will start to really get involved around 2026, which feels about right. So I think in the next couple of years, it's a little bit like the Wild West. It's a little bit like the early stages of, you know, e-commerce. There'll be a lot of test and learn. There'll be some great successes, some failures. But consumer-wise, it feels like it's, as I say, tech-orientated people who are really in at the outset. Then you start to get the early adopters. But number-wise, you don't get to the majority of people until, you know, a good few years further down the line. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a great opportunity in the short term if you've got the right brand targeting the right customers and you can really understand how to use the metaverse to engage. So thank you for that insight.
Just a quick one to add. We're looking at it. I mean, we're doing a huge innovation this year at Lazerde, but it's something that I'm going to look into more and do some tests on next year, because for us in the Middle East region, Lazerde is a very well-known brand, right, with the jewelry that they design. Got very unique design pieces. And actually in MENA, 51% of all online gamers, we talked about Roblox and Frontier, Fortnite, for example, are females, believe it or not. You wouldn't assume that, right? But here in
one of my colleagues is female, and she is a big full-on gamer. You know, she spends, I think, probably 3/4 of her weekend basically gaming, but there you go. Tell me something. Who do you, as you look around the retail industry at the moment, who are the exemplars? Who are the brands that you kind of admire? You look to and you think they're on it. You know, they're on it both now and kind of where they're going.
Yeah, two brands come to my mind that I actually have a lot of respect for. Obviously, first and foremost, Apple. I think these guys are brilliant. Their experience, whether it's online, whether it's offline, is exemplary, and it's consistent. And it's consistent at a global level. Any Apple store you walk into in the world, you get that same consistent experience. And the other one I really like is Lululemon. Lululemon are doing the experiential side in their stores quite well. So they're actually leveraging their stores after closing hours to turn it into yoga studios with local communities of customers and their own customers, inviting them in, paying for an evening with a yoga instructor. Mm-hmm. And they're really bringing that sort of community together in the high street. So, you know, more with what you mentioned before in that store in Westfield and what Lululemon are doing, for example, if more brands and retailers started to adopt that kind of approach, how can I engage at each store level with my local community better? That's going to be businesses that, you know, I think are going to be sustainably grow for the next 10, 15, 20 years if they keep mantra.
Totally agree. Yeah, I love both those examples, but I really like the example of Lululemon. And, you know, I can't remember the name of the store, actually. I'm having a senior moment, but there was a store in Colchester that sells vintage products. And I went in there once when I was doing some high street reviews. And what was interesting is they had it's not a big store. I mean, it's only a few hundred square. It's literally, I don't know what it is. It must have been about 500 or 600 square feet. And they had a few chairs around, and they had like tea and coffee and scones, so you could come in, buy some products on, but you could also sit and socialize. But then they had a stage at the back of the store, and all the products on the shop floor were movable on wheels, and that's what Lululemon do. So you could literally clear a space, and there was a stage at the back of the store, and they would run, and they would have bands on a Friday night. And that particular retailer I was talking about, Situ Live, they have a music stage, a sound stage, sponsored by Sony, and have live bands, you know, playing in the store. And I just love that. I love that whole concept of, okay, it might be traditionally a retail space, but how else might we leverage it to engage with, you know, consumers and also monetize it, right? It doesn't just have to be about selling products. So I thought that was a good example. And Lululemon's a great example as well of really bringing the brand to life in a very relevant way in terms of what they sell. I think I read recently that you made your name onto, or your name made its way onto a top 100 chief digital officer list. I've been privileged to be on a couple of lists over the years. It's a good moment in your career. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I was humbled by it, actually. I wasn't expecting it, and didn't know, still don't know who's nominated me to this moment and how I've managed to get my name onto that. But so the global CDO top 100 list, last month I was called by them and told I've made that list. And you know, it's a satisfying, from a personal perspective, it's a satisfying moment because I'm one of those guys that doesn't really like to go and talk too much at conferences when I'm working for a business. I'd rather do the work, then go and talk, and then show what we've done. So we've done some phenomenal work in the Middle East over the last, in the businesses I've worked in the Middle East and before in digital space. So to finally make that list is an honor. It's a privilege, very humbled by it. And yeah, you know, even more motivated to do even more innovation and grow the businesses that I'm working for at the moment. Very happy.
Congratulations. It's a very good moment in anybody's career when, you know, when you get that level of recognition from peers or industry bodies or whatever it happens to be, you know, it is very rewarding. Yes, it's humbling. Absolutely. But, you know, it's a well-deserved pat on the back. And I think as I look at your career and, you know, the different environments that you've worked in and what you've achieved when you've been there, you know, I think it's fantastic. And I personally, as a friend and somebody who's known you a long time, very proud of what you've achieved. So very well done.
You had a big hand in it. Like you mentioned earlier. No, you did. Yeah, you've been a really good mentor for me through my career. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. Tell me, if you were going back, if you were out on your own, let's imagine you weren't where you are at the moment in Egypt, and you were going to open a retail business. What would it be? What would the model be? What sort of category would you want to get involved in, and what would the business look like? Give us an idea of that, would you?
Yeah, absolutely. Very similar to the model you mentioned, which is why I'm very keen to look at it in Westfield, because I've been thinking about that for a while, having a store that does not hold stock. If you can imagine a fashion business, for example, retailer, imagine having a store that's got live event being a fashion show. So you've got different models. It could be everyday models that are customers that are in there doing a fashion show. Just a micro example. So you've got all the clothes happening on a proper catwalk, and you've got customers in there watching it. It's being live streamed on the app. You literally can click the item that you like, add it to your basket, pay, and either it gets delivered by the end of the show when you're leaving the store in a bag to you, or it gets delivered to your home, depending on how you want. So I think immersing that experience into an environment that draws the customer to want to come there. You're not top heavy on putting stock into your stores, but perhaps you can, you know, get your money or your revenue through charging brands, just the way that the business that you mentioned is doing. But for me, if I had to choose one category, I've been getting into the fitness regime quite a lot, working up early, working out. So I'd like to see a similar kind of model that we've just talked about now, but selling vitamins and supplements that help keep you healthy and help you, depending on what type of training regime you're on. So having an environment that's kind of like for fitness freaks that like to go work out, so it's like a gym. At the same time, you've got physios there, you've got the supplements that you can sell at that moment in time or to get delivered. And more importantly, that can then dovetail, in my opinion, into a subscription model. Because if you're doing your regime with 5 days a week or 7 days a week or 2 days a week, you know when the supplement's going to finish. So you can have a different subscription model, like once every month or once every 3 months, automatically orders me that. So something along that line that we've been talking about throughout this, and the category I would probably choose is fitness and well-being, because I think that is also very high on people's agendas, right?
Totally agree. Absolutely. It very much is so. And I think never more so, obviously, having been stuck in lockdowns for months on end over the last couple of years, you know, I think people's focus on their health and well-being has never been more prominent. So I agree. I think that'd be a really interesting space to get involved in. I like the idea, I like the concept of what you're talking about. So you never know, watch this space. Maybe you and I eventually will do something like that together. Who knows? Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your insight. I really enjoyed having you on, and it's always great to keep in touch and see your career go from strength to strength. So I wish you all the best for the future. Stay well, stay healthy, and stay successful. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Martin. Pleasure is all mine.
If you would like to know more about what we're doing at Customer Service Action, the platform where people can share their good and bad customer service stories and experiences in one impartial place, then please visit customerserviceaction.com. Please remember to subscribe on your favorite podcast app so you can be notified when we go live with future episodes. Thank you so much for joining us today on Customer Centricity with me, Martin Newman.